Some of them actually used to support our show. And because I've said this alt-left stuff is bad, it's really, really bad, they've started to cancel memberships and they're trying to hurt us financially. And that's okay. I don't want their money. I don't. But I would love it if you came in and said, David, I actually appreciate what you're doing on the Ukraine-Russia issue. Sign up at joinpacman.com. It's really cheap. And you'll also get access to an extra show every day called The Bonus Show. Alex Jones hates The Bonus Show.
Oh, The Bonus Show, where you want to make money. But everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Yeah. You'll also get The Daily Show commercial free 6 hours before everybody else. So sign up at joinpacman.com. We'll see you on The Bonus Show. Tomorrow we'll have a new show, a new bonus show, and I will be live for Joe Biden's State of the Union.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
CT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me. For all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
RCT in sound from way out.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh, yeah. yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Has entered its sixth day as a 40-mile Russian military convoy heads toward Kiev while Russia bombs Ukraine's second-largest city. We'll go to Kiev to speak with a Ukrainian peace activist. Then a 500,000 civilians have fled Ukraine.
It is so scary. You don't know what will happen. A bomb can fall at any minute, and there's nothing you can do. All day, the air raid sirens go off in all the towns. It's very scary.
Plus, we look at the roots of the crisis in Ukraine with Andrew Coburn of Harper's Magazine and Yale University professor Timothy Snyder. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ukraine's government has accused Russia of war crimes for deliberately targeting civilians during its invasion of Ukraine. New satellite photos show a massive 40-mile convoy of Russian tanks and armored vehicles stretching from the Russian border to the outskirts of Ukraine's capital, Kiev. Ukrainian officials say troops from Belarus have joined Russia's invasion. Elsewhere, Russia's military has begun shelling residential areas of Kharkiv, Ukraine's second-largest city. Today, a Russian missile struck Kharkiv's local government building, leaving a massive crater in the city center known as Freedom Square. Another Russian assault on Monday destroyed a children's clothing factory in Kharkiv.
This is a residential area with no military objects, and people lived very close to this building where the missile hit.
Human rights groups say Russia's used thermobaric weapons in its assault. These so-called vacuum bombs are the most powerful non-nuclear explosives used in warfare. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch documented a Russian cluster bomb attack on a hospital in eastern Ukraine that killed 4 civilians, injured another 10. A United Nations treaty banning the use of cluster munitions has been signed by over 100 nations, although Russia, Ukraine, and the United States have refused to sign onto the prohibition. On Monday, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of war crimes for deliberately targeting civilians. He spoke after Russian and Ukrainian officials met on the Belarusian border to discuss a possible ceasefire. Those talks failed.
These talks took place while our territory, our cities were being bombed and shelled. We could see the synchronization of the shelling with the negotiation process. I believe that in this unsophisticated way, Russia is trying to apply pressure. Don't waste our time. We do not accept such tactics.
Earlier today, President Zelensky addressed the European Parliament by video link. On Monday, he called on the European Union to grant Ukraine immediate membership to the 27-nation bloc. At The Hague, a prosecutor for the International Criminal Court said Monday he'll launch an investigation into possible war crimes or crimes against humanity committed by Russia in Ukraine. At the United Nations, the General Assembly began an emergency session Monday to debate a draft resolution calling on Russia to end its military campaign. This is UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Yesterday, Russian nuclear forces were put on high alert. This is a chilling development. The mere idea of a nuclear conflict is simply inconceivable. Nothing can justify the use of nuclear weapons.
The oil and gas giant Shell said Monday it'll exit its joint ventures with Russia's state-owned energy company Gazprom. Shell has about $3 billion invested in Russian operations. This follows a similar move by BP to offload its Russian operations as other oil companies, including ExxonMobil and Total, come under pressure to divest. In Moscow, Russia's central bank more than doubled its interest rate to 20% to prevent the further collapse of Russia's currency after governments around the world imposed sanctions. The value of the ruble dropped to less than one U.S. cent on Monday. That's about 1/20th of the ruble's value in 2014 before Russia's annexation of Crimea. United Nations warns some 4 million refugees could leave Ukraine in the coming weeks. Filippo Grandi is the UN High Commissioner for Refugees.
As we speak, there are 520,000 refugees from Ukraine in neighboring countries. This figure has been rising exponentially, hour after hour, literally, since Thursday.
More than half of those who fled have crossed Ukraine's western border into Poland. Foreign nationals report they've been barred from crossing, even as Ukrainian citizens have been welcomed with open arms. India's government's dispatch ministers to Ukraine's borders after Indians seeking to cross into Poland reported they were turned around and told to go to Romania instead. Citizens of several African countries report they were pushed back from Poland because they're black. This is Eli Mbama, a student from Congo.
We had to stay outside, exposed to the freezing weather that they have here. Nobody tells us where we can find shelter, and we are left out in the cold.
Last November, Poland massed troops along its border, firing tear gas and water cannons to block thousands of refugees, most of them from the Middle East, from crossing into Poland, where they were seeking asylum in the EU. That contrasts with about 300,000 Ukrainian refugees welcomed to Poland within just the last several days. Major international news outlets are facing backlash over racist comments made by correspondents comparing the invasion of Ukraine to conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, and other regions outside of Europe. Correspondents from Al Jazeera English, The Telegraph, CBS News, and others have suggested Ukrainians and their resistance are more worthy of sympathy because they're, quote, civilized and white. This is Charlie DeGatta, senior correspondent of CBS News, speaking on air Friday.
This isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
The Arab and Middle Eastern Journalists Association condemns such comments as orientalist and racist. The group added, quote, this type of commentary reflects the pervasive mentality in Western journalism of normalizing tragedy in parts of the world, such as the Middle East, Africa, South Asia, and Latin America. It dehumanizes and renders their experience with war as somehow normal and expected, unquote. In Australia, torrential rains and record flooding have inundated the eastern states of Queensland and New South Wales, killing at least 8 people, forcing tens of thousands to evacuate. Residents could be seen taking refuge on rooftops as the fast-rising waters submerge their homes. This is the Premier of New South Wales.
Simply because your community has not flooded in the past does not mean that it will not flood over the course of this week. What we are seeing today is unprecedented. And the advice that we have received is that we would expect things to get worse over this period of time.
Back in the United States, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments on Monday in a case brought by coal companies against the Environmental Protection Agency. Coal executives are challenging the EPA's authority to regulate carbon emissions from power plants under the Clean Air Act. Justices with the court's conservative majority appeared sympathetic to arguments that the Obama and Biden administrations exceeded their authority when the EPA and not Congress sought to regulate greenhouse gases. President Biden will be addressing a joint session of Congress this evening in his first State of the Union address. Ahead of the speech, the Pentagon called up several hundred National Guard soldiers. Meanwhile, police re-erected a security barrier on Capitol grounds that was first set up last year in the wake of the January 6th insurrection. Far-right groups have announced plans for a trucker convoy protest outside the State of the Union, modeled after protests that paralyzed the Canadian Capitol for weeks. Those plans are in doubt after several trucks involved in the so-called People's Convoy crashed in Oklahoma on their way to Washington, D.C. In California, a father fatally shot his three children Monday during a supervised family visit at a church near Sacramento. The shooter also killed a person who may have been supervising the visit before taking his own life. The mother of the children reportedly had a restraining order against the father, which should have prevented him from obtaining a firearm. The children were 9, 10, and 13 years old. In the past 7 days, there have been over 700 gun-related deaths in the U.S., according to the Shock Market, a new online tool that tracks gun violence. And a Democrat-led bill in Congress would have codified abortion rights into federal law. It's been blocked by the Senate. Conservative Democratic Senator Joe Manchin joined Senate Republicans who used the threat of a filibuster to block the Women's Health Protection Act. The legislation was approved by House Democrats last year in response to a wave of state laws almost completely banning abortion. This is Washington Democratic Senator Patty Murray.
Republicans have made it abundantly clear they want a world in which they, as politicians, get to decide what women can do with their bodies, their lives, and their futures. That is not what the vast majority of Americans want. The vast majority of Americans want a country where the very personal, individual decision about pregnancy is, wait for it, up to the individual.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our viewers and listeners across the country and around the world.
Well, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has entered its sixth day, with Russia escalating its bombardment. Satellite images show up to a 40-mile convoy of Russian armored vehicles, tanks, and artillery heading to Kiev, the capital of Ukraine. Earlier today, a Russian missile hit a government building in Kharkiv, causing a huge explosion in Ukraine's second-largest city. Civilian areas in Kharkiv have also been shelled. Ukrainian authorities also reported more than 70 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed in the eastern city of Otyrka after a Russian missile strike on a military base. On Monday, Ukraine and Russia held 5 hours of talks near the Belarus border, but no agreement was reached. The two sides are expected to meet again in the coming days. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has called for a no-fly zone over Ukraine, but the United States and its allies have ruled out the idea, saying it could lead to a broader war. Ukraine and human rights groups have also accused Russia of targeting civilians with cluster and thermobaric bombs. Those so-called vacuum bombs are the most powerful non-nuclear explosives used in warfare. Russia has denied targeting civilians or civilian infrastructure. Meanwhile, the International Criminal Courts announced plans to investigate war crimes in Ukraine. At the United Nations, the General Assembly held an emergency meeting Monday to discuss the crisis. This is Ukraine's Ambassador Sergei Kislytsy.
If Ukraine does not survive, international peace will not survive. If Ukraine does not survive, the United Nations will not survive. Have no illusions. If Ukraine does not survive, we cannot be surprised if democracy fails next. Now we can save Ukraine, save the United Nations, save democracy, and defend the values we believe in.
And just before we went to broadcast, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, addressed the European Parliament by video. At the end, the parliament gave him a standing ovation. We go now to Kiev, where we're joined by Yuri Shelyachenko. He is the executive secretary of the Ukrainian Pacifist Movement and a board member of the European Bureau of Conscientious Objection. Yuri is also a member of the board of directors at World Beyond War and a research associate at Kroc University in Kiev. Yuri Shelyachenko, welcome back to Democracy Now! We spoke to you just before the Russian invasion. Can you talk about what's happening on the ground right now and what you are calling for as a pacifist?
Good day. Thank you for balanced journalism and covering peace process a part of pains and passions of war. Military polarization between the East and West went too far with reckless military operations, NATO expansion, Russian invasion to Ukraine and nuclear threats to world, militarization of Ukraine with exclusion of Russia from international institutions and expulsions of Russian diplomats, literally pushing Putin from diplomacy to escalation of war. Instead of breaking the last bonds of humanity out of rage, we need more than ever to preserve and strengthen venues of communication and cooperation between all people on Earth, and each individual effort of that sort has a value. And it is disappointing that support of Ukraine on the West is mainly military support, and the imposition of painful economic sanctions on Russia and reporting on conflict focuses on warfare and almost ignores nonviolent resistance to war, because brave Ukrainian civilians are changing street signs and blocking streets and blocking tanks, staying on their way without weapons, like tank men, to stop the war. For example, in Berdyansk city and Karyukivka village, people organized peace rallies and convinced Russian military to get out. Peace movement warned for years that reckless militarization will lead to war. We were right. We prepared many people for peaceful dispute resolution, for nonviolent resistance to aggression. We upheld human rights, universal obligations to help refugees. It helps now and gives hope for peaceful solution, which exists always. I wish to all people of us universal peace and happiness, no wars today and forever. But unfortunately, while the most of people, most of time in most of places live in peace, my beautiful city of Kyiv, capital of Ukraine, and other Ukrainian cities are targets of Russian bombardments. Just before this interview, I heard again distant sounds of explosions from windows, sirens howl many times during a day, last several days. Hundreds of people are killed, including children, because of Russian aggression. Thousands are injured, hundreds of thousands of people are displaced and seeking refuge abroad, additionally to millions internally displaced persons and refugees in Russia and in Europe after 8 years of war between Ukrainian government and Russia-backed separatists in Donbass. All males in the age from 18 to 60 are restricted in freedom of movement abroad and called to participate in war effort without exceptions to conscientious objector to military service, and those who are fleeing from war too. War Resisters International strongly criticized this decision of Ukrainian government to prohibit all male citizens in age 18 to 60 to leave the country and demanded a withdrawal of these decisions. I admire massive anti-war rallies in Russia. Courageous, peaceful citizens who nonviolently oppose Putin's war machine under threats of arrest and punishment. Our friends, conscientious objection movement in Russia, also members of European Bureau for Conscientious Objection, condemns the Russian military aggression and calls on Russia to stop the war, calls all recruits to refuse military service and apply for alternative civilian service or claim exemption on medical grounds. And there are peace rallies around the world in support of peace in Ukraine. 500,000 of people in Berlin hazard to protest against war. There are anti-war actions in Italy, in France. Our friends from Gensuikuo, the Japan Council Against Atomic and Hydrogen Bombs, responded to Putin nuclear threats with protest rallies in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I invite you to seek for recent international and United States anti-war events at the website worldbeyondwar.org to participate in the Global Day of Action to Stop the War in Ukraine on March 6 under a slogan Russian troops out, no NATO expansion, organized by Code Pink and other peace groups. It is a shame that Russia and Ukraine up to now failed to negotiate ceasefire and failed even to agree on safe humanitarian corridors for evacuation of civilians. Negotiations between Ukraine and Russia didn't achieve a ceasefire. Putin needs neutral status of Ukraine, denazification, demilitarization of Ukraine, and approval that Crimea belongs to Russia, which is contrary to international law. He told it to Macron. So we know these demands of Putin. Ukrainian delegation on negotiations was ready to discuss only ceasefire and Russian troops leaving Ukraine because, of course, territorial integrity matters of Ukraine. Ukraine continued shelling of Donetsk while Russia bombarded Kharkiv and other cities. Basically, both parties, Ukraine and Russia, are belligerent and not willing to calm down. Putin and Zelensky should engage in peace talks seriously and in good faith as responsible politicians and representatives of the people on the basis of common public interests instead of fighting for mutually exclusive positions. I hope
Yuri Shelezenko, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned President Zelensky. He's being hailed in many of the Western media as a hero since the invasion. What is your assessment of how President Zelensky has been functioning in this crisis?
President Zelensky is totally surrendered to war machine. He pursues military solution and he fails to call Putin and ask directly to stop the war. I hope that with the help of all people in the world telling the truth to the power, demanding to stop shooting and start talking, aiding those who need it and investing into the peace culture and education for nonviolent citizenship, we could together build a better world without armies and borders, a world where truth and love are great powers embracing East and West. I believe that nonviolence is a more effective and progressive tool for global governance, social and environmental justice. The delusions about systemic violence and war as panacea, a miraculous solution for all social problems, are false. The sanctions which the West and the East are imposing on each other as a result of battle for control over Ukraine between the United States and Russia may weaken, but will not split the global market of ideas, labor, goods, and finances. So the global market will inevitably find a way to satisfy its need in global government. Question is how civilized and how democratic will be the future global government. And military alliances aimed to uphold absolute sovereignty are promoting despotism rather than democracy. When NATO members provide military aid to support sovereignty of Ukrainian government or when Russia sends troops to fight for self-proclaimed sovereignty of Donetsk and Luhansk separatists, you should remember that unchecked sovereignty means bloodshed, and sovereignty is definitely not democratic value. All democracies emerged from resistance to bloodthirsty sovereigns, individual and collective. War profiteers of the West are the same threat to democracy as the authoritarian rulers of the East, and their attempts to divide and rule the earth are essentially similar. NATO should step back from conflict around Ukraine, escalated by its support to war effort and aspirations of membership of Ukrainian government. And ideally, NATO should dissolve or transform into an alliance of disarmament instead of military alliance.
Let me ask you something, Yuri. We just got this word in. You know, Zelensky has just addressed by video the European Parliament. They gave him a standing ovation after, and the European Parliament has just approved Ukraine's application to join the European Union. What is your response to that?
I feel proud for my country that we are joined to alliance of Western democracies, European Union, which is a peaceful union, and I hope that whole the world in the future will be peaceful union. But unfortunately, European Union as well as Ukraine have a similar problem of militarization. civilization. And it looks like a dystopian Ministry of Peace in Orwell's novel 1984, when European Peace Facility provides military assistance to Ukraine, but there is almost absent assistance to non-violent solution to current crisis and to demilitarization. I hope, of course, Ukraine belongs to Europe. Ukraine is a democratic country, and it is great that Ukrainian application to join the European Union is approved, but I think that this consolidation of West should not be consolidation against so-called enemy, against the East. East and West should find peaceful reconciliation and should pursue global governance, unity of all people in the world without armies and borders. This consolidation of West should not lead to war against East. East and West should be friends and live peacefully and demilitarize. And of course, the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons is one of venues of total demilitarization, which we are needed desperately. You know, now we have a problem of archaic governance based on sovereignty of nation states. When, for example, when Ukraine prohibits many citizens to participate in public life speaking Russian, it seems like normal. It seems like sovereignty. It is not, of course. It is not a just cause for invasion and military aggression, of course, as Putin claims, but it is not right. And of course, the West many time ago should say to Ukraine that human rights is a very important value and freedom of expression, including linguistic rights, are matter. And representation of pro-Russian people, Russian-speaking people in political life is important thing. And oppression of culture of our neighbor and their diaspora in Ukraine, of course, will infuriate Kremlin. And it infuriated and indeed this crisis should be de-escalated, not escalated. And this this indeed great day when Ukraine was recognized European nation should not be the prelude for opposition, military opposition between Europe and Russia. But I hope that Russia will head out with their military forces from Ukraine and will also join European Union and European Union and Shanghai Cooperation Organization and other regional alliances, African Union and so on, in future will be parts of united global political entity, global governance, as Immanuel Kant in his beautiful pamphlet Perpetual Peace envisaged. You know, plan of Immanuel Kant for...
Yuri Shelchenko, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the issue of de-escalating the situation and seeking to achieve peace, Ukraine has requested a no-fly zone over certain areas of Ukraine. That would obviously have to be enforced by the militaries of the European Union and the United States. What do you feel about this issue of a call for a no-fly zone over Ukraine?
It is continuation of this line to escalation, to engage whole West united in military aspect to oppose Russia. Putin already responded to this with nuclear threats because he is infuriated, because he is, of course, scared, as well as we scared today in Kyiv and the West scared about this situation. Now we should stay calm. We should think rationally. We should unite indeed, but not unite to escalate conflict and give military response. We should unite pursuing peaceful solution of conflict, negotiations between Putin and Zelensky, presidents of Russia and Ukraine, between Biden and Putin, between the United States and Russia. Peace talks things about future are the key, because people start war when they lose hopes in future. And today we need revive hopes in future. We have peace culture, which are starting to develop throughout the world. We have old archaic culture of violence, structural violence, cultural violence. The most of people are not trying to be angels or demons. They are drifting between culture of peace and culture of violence.
Yuri, before we go, we just wanted to ask you, since you are in Kyiv, the military convoy is just outside of Kyiv. Are you planning to leave like so many Ukrainians have tried to leave and have left, something like estimates of 500,000 Ukrainians over the borders into Poland, Romania, and other places? Or are you staying put?
As I said, there is no safe humanitarian corridors agreed by Russia and Ukraine for living civilians. It is one of failures in negotiations. As I said, our government thinks that all males should participate in war efforts and blatantly violates human right to conscientious objection to military service. So it is no way for pacifists to flee, I stay with peaceful Ukraine here, and I hope that peaceful Ukraine will not be destroyed by this polarized, militarized world.
Yuri Shelyashenko, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Yes, males between the ages of 18 and 60 are not allowed to leave Ukraine. Yuri is the executive secretary of the Ukrainian Pacifist Movement, board member of the European Bureau for Conscientious Objection, also member of the board of directors at World Beyond War and research associate at Kroc University in Kyiv, Ukraine. Coming up, we look at the roots of the crisis in Ukraine. We'll be joined by Andrew Coburn of Harper's Magazine and Yale University Professor Timothy Snyder. Stay with us.
Try to remember the kind of September when life was slow and oh so mellow. Try to remember the kind of September when grass was green and the grain was yellow. Try to remember the kind of September when you were young and a callow fellow. Try to remember, and if you remember, then follow, follow.
Try to remember Harry Belafonte. He turns 95 years old today. Happy birthday, Harry. If you want to see our interviews over the years with Harry Belafonte, you can go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Ukraine's government has accused Russia of war crimes for deliberately targeting civilians during its invasion of Ukraine. New satellite photos show a massive 40-mile convoy of Russian tanks and armored vehicles stretching from the Russian border to the outskirts of Ukraine's capital, Kiev. Ukrainian officials say troops from Belarus have joined Russia's invasion. As we continue to look at the invasion of Ukraine, we're joined by two guests, Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale University, permanent fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, author of many books, including The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America, and recently Armality, Lessons in Liberty from a Hospital Diary. We're also joined by Andrew Coburn, the Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. His book, just out, is called The Spoils of War: Power, Profit, and the American War Machine. Andrew Coburn, let's begin with you. If you can start off by responding to the latest news, this Russian convoy of 40 miles coming closer and closer to Kiev. Ukraine's second city, Kharkiv, has been bombed, the local municipal building as well as other sites. The massive departure of Ukrainians fleeing a war, half a million Ukrainians, massively women and children, going to Poland, Romania, and other places. Can you comment on what's happening today?
Yes, well, it looks like, we hear a lot about how the Russian offensive has, slowed down, being, ground to a halt, or is being, met up unexpected resistance, which, is true. On the other hand, they do seem to be moving fairly steadily in a sort of a slightly creaky way towards their objectives. I mean, they've surrounded the Kharkiv and Kyiv. They've done, their separatist forces, presumably reinforced by regular Russian troops, have done quite well in the east, have advanced out, have taken most of the Donetsk and Luhansk provinces. The forces coming out of Crimea are, advancing, it seems, fairly successfully. They've got Mariupol surrounded, which they regard as a sort of heartland of what they call neo-Nazi, the Azov battalion, the extreme rightist elements that this, from Putin's point of view, this whole war is meant to be about. So, I would think that they've, the Russians, in a sort of slightly warped way, may be quite pleased with, or the Russian high command may be quite pleased with the way things are going. Yes, of course, I mean, it's, the horrible tragedy of the all these refugees, and as I'm glad you pointed out, in sharp contrast to the way people from the Middle East and, non-white or whatever, non-European refugees have been treated by the Poles and the EU generally. It's interesting what Yuri Shelyazenko just said, of course. I mean, that does not include people from the refugees, don't seem to include people from Kyiv, because, the way is blocked. The Russians have, occupied the, as I say, they've encircled the city. So the people from Kyiv, the people really under threat, can't get out. And there's been no negotiation, or certainly no successful negotiation on a humanitarian corridor. I mean, it's curious. I mean, it's hard. This is such a fog of war that there's so much misinformation flying around. I mean, it's interesting whether or not the Russians really have achieved air superiority in Ukraine. I mean, one of the interesting things, and maybe one of the disappointments from the Russian point of view, is that the Russian Air Force hasn't really been present, or hasn't really been successful in the way you might have thought, from all the sort of threat inflation we've heard in recent years about how Russia's become a mighty power. I mean, I think And obviously, they've been fighting in Syria. The Air Force certainly has for the last few years, so that's probably put a strain on them. I've heard that they're running out of precision-guided munitions, which may be a problem. But generally, I mean, given the disastrous calculation, in my view, and heinous calculation by Putin to go ahead with this, I would say they may think they're not doing too badly.
And, Alexander, I wanted to ask you about that. In terms of the media is portraying this as the Russian army already bogged down 5 days into this war. But I looked back at the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, yeah. Which started on March 20th, and it took until April 9th. It took 3 weeks for the U.S. military against a far less powerful army in Iraq to reach Baghdad. And of course, the war was initiated by a week of massive bombardment of Iraqi cities and of the military, the Iraqi military, to basically decimate the military before the troops started moving. In retrospect, and I completely agree with you that this was a crazy and fundamentally unjust invasion. But on the other hand, it seems that Russia has not sought this kind of shock and awe approach to just bomb the cities and instead it's chosen to send its armies in and to try to capture the cities in a methodical way, almost as a— some experts have said that they're seeking— they understand that if there's massive casualties among the Ukrainian people, that will be not looked upon kindly even by the Russian population.
Right. You know, and it would be a 100-year war. No, I'm really glad you point that out. I mean, as you say, it took 3 weeks for the U.S. and British to reach Baghdad. And, you know, most of the time they were advancing across desert. So, but this looks like a sort of really like a lightning blitzkrieg in comparison. And obviously, it's also correct, as you say, that the Russians, Putin, didn't really, you know, didn't want to sort of permanently alienate the Ukrainian population. I mean, it seems fairly clear that he's, you know, united them, or certainly united a huge proportion of them now in opposition to Russia in a way that may not have been the case a few weeks ago. But yeah, it's been, you know, I've been thinking, where one on, you know, CNN or something with one of these old hacks from the Pentagon who they're wheeling on to comment and cheer on our side in Ukraine, I'd like to ask them how they would have invaded Ukraine. I mean, and as you say, it's fairly clear what would have happened. It would have been massive destruction, started with massive destruction of infrastructure, as happened in the two Iraq wars that we were engaged in, and bombing water treatment plants and power stations and communications and all the rest that's, you know, become the traditional U.S. way of war. So, you know, I'm glad that the Russians at least haven't so far gone in for that. That may change, but there is a sharp contrast, and you know, very little of which gets mentioned in the official media, because it's open season on hypocrisy.
And Andrew Coburn, could you talk about the sanctions in place that the West is exacting on Russia, the impact it will have not only on Russia, but clearly on especially Western Europe?
Well, exactly. We've gotten used to sanctions. It's become really the premier U.S. and foreign policy tool of, we've been sanctioned, you know, Cuba for decades, for half a century. We sanctioned Iraq, sanctioned Iran, sanctioned Syria. And we got used to it. It's a great way to beat up, you know, small, comparatively powerless countries who have little really input and impact on the global economy. Now, if they didn't think about it before, they're certainly realizing that, first of all, I should say quickly, obviously it's having disastrous effects on the Russian economy, but it's very interesting. I mean, car factories in Germany are already closing down because they can't get parts that have turned out to be sourced from Russia and indeed Ukraine. It turns out, you know, a lot of people are discovering for the first time that Russia and Ukraine, between them, supply a third of the world's wheat supply, wheat production, which is, you know, what a lot of the Middle East eats, Iraq, Egypt particularly. I mean, you're going to see if the price of bread can't be controlled there, you're going to see, I think, great sort of dissension and riots there. Semiconductors, you know, can't be made here without a supplies of various sort of ingredients most of us have never heard of that come from Russia. So in a way, now that it's all out economic warfare, we're finding that it's there's a lot of pushback, a lot of payback in a sense, and in a way we've sanctioned ourselves as well.
I want to bring Timothy Snyder into the conversation, Yale historian, author of many books, including The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America, and On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Your response to the latest developments right now?
Well, so we know what Russia's initial war plan was. It was premised on Mr. Putin's assumption that Ukrainians and Russians are really one people. So if he can simply send in a strike force to surround the Ukrainian capital and physically eliminate the Ukrainian government, then everyone will go over to the Russian side. We know that because it's consistent with the initial attack plan. We also know it because they accidentally published these documents a couple of days ago. So when we want to look at what's happening, I think we have to distinguish stage one, which was a failure thanks to unexpectedly strong and intelligent Ukrainian resistance on the part of people who are essentially defending their homes, by the way, also from attacks on water supply, energy supply, apartment buildings, and everything which was listed already. All those things have already been attacked, including cities. But so in stage one, the Russian plan fails because of Ukrainian resistance, but also because of its nature. Now we're moving to stage two, which will include precisely the things which were described before. We're moving towards more like a Grozny scenario or a Syria scenario where the Russians will do what the Russians do in their doctrine. They besiege cities and then they pound them from the outside and with air power until the civilians force the leadership to capitulate. So unless these columns can be somehow stopped, or we can get to some kind of negotiated solution by way of pressure on Russia, we're going to see a much more horrifying stage of this war follow.
And Professor Snyder, can you talk about the you've mentioned Putin's belief that Ukraine and Russia are part of one nation. Can you describe your view of the historical truth here?
Well, I guess I would say even if Mr. Putin were a historian, it's not the job of a historian to say who belongs to what nation. You know, it's not my job to tell people, you know, in Africa what nations they belong to, or Canadians whether they belong to a nation or not. A nation is a group of people with a common sense about what the future holds and what they should be doing. And in that sense, Ukrainians are indisputably a nation. The history, I mean, since you ask, is just unbelievably wrong and abusive. The idea that because a Viking baptized himself 1,000 years ago, maybe, therefore Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia are one nation is palpably absurd. The idea that the Bolsheviks created Ukraine, as Mr. Putin claims, is also ridiculous. It's the other way around. The Soviet Union was created as a union, as a federation with national names, precisely because 100 years ago, even the far left in Russia was perfectly aware that Ukraine was a nation and had to be accommodated in some way. And this language, by the way, this language that other people are not states, that other people are not nations, that is the language of destroying the state and of destroying the nation. That's the logic that follows. And since we're on the topic, another of Mr. Putin's historical claims or abuses of historical language is the idea that he's carrying out a denazification campaign, when in fact what his army is doing is set up to do is to destroy a government which is led by a democratically elected Jewish president. He's abusing the historical legacy that we have, and he's abusing our ability to use history to try to make some kind of judgment on what's happening now.
We're going to break, then come back to this conversation. We're talking to Yale historian Timothy Snyder. He is author of many books, including On Tyranny and the Road to Unfreedom. And we're talking to Andrew Coburn. His book is just out. It's called The Spoils of War. He writes for Harper's Magazine. Stay with us.
Пулі рви, штикно, сунь винь, прикскок, десятитисячелетнім склепі, спіти відять сниги, беклі тепі, меркнет небо, одинокий путник, топает по полю, ветер гонит стополя пух и пророчит пополь вух. Оставил свое сердце в чеченице, торговля органами, бойко кипит почки семьи за похлебку из чечевицы. Канта, Сартра, харкнут, варвары, маглы, мавры, Северная Африка, контейнеры мигрантов, лотерея, верхний миллиард, либо грузом на дне священный рандом. В зеркале мелькает метаморф, это красавец, то урод, в зависимости от углов и освещения, ущелье, жестокая резня, порой сказать не просто, где уродство, а где красота. Баландер и лобстер, машала, черт с ним, красота с уродством, буйствует сатана, крестит апостол, уродство и красота.
Beauty and Ugliness by Russian rapper Oxymiron. The rapper canceled six sold-out shows in St. Petersburg and Moscow, his first headlining tour in 5 years, to protest the war, saying, I want to say that I am against this specific war that Russia is waging against the Ukrainian people. I believe this is a catastrophe and a crime. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue to look at Russia's invasion of Europe. I want to turn back to a comment on Democracy Now! In 2014 made by the late historian Stephen Cohen about how NATO expansion in Eastern Europe could lead to war.
When we took in, we meaning the United States and NATO, all these countries in Eastern Europe into NATO, we agreed with the Russians we would not put forward military installations there. We built some infrastructure, airstrips, there's some barracks, stuff like that. But we didn't station troops that could march toward Russia there. Now what NATO is saying, it is time to do that. Now, Russia already felt encircled by NATO member states on its borders. The Baltics are on its borders. If we move the forces, NATO forces, including American troops, toward Russia's borders, where will we be then? I mean, it's obviously going to militarize the situation and therefore raise the danger of war. And I think it's important to emphasize, though I regret saying this, Russia will not back off. This is existential.
That's historian Stephen Cohen, the late historian, speaking in 2014 on Democracy Now! We're speaking now with Andrew Coburn, Harper's Magazine, Washington editor, his new book, The Spoils of War, Power, Profit, and the American War Machine, and Yale University professor of history, Timothy Snyder, author of On Tyranny and the Road to Unfreedom. Andrew Coburn, can you respond to this? And then we'll get the response of Professor Snyder.
Well, Steve Cohen, you know, he was exactly right. I mean, you know, what he said would happen has happened. So I don't know, we hardly need to argue about it. I mean, it was, there's many, I'm sure that the whole story of NATO expansion will become further encrusted with myth, but it is certainly the case that that we did, you know, there were promises made to Gorbachev and the then Soviet leadership at the time of the German unification, reunification, at the end of the Cold War, that NATO would not expand beyond Germany. I mean, the Russians sort of agreed that the that all of Germany would be in NATO, but they did say they wouldn't expand further. And for some reason, the Soviets believed them, that when they didn't have much option, of course. So, you know, there has been then the further expansion of, there was in Poland, the first tranche was in came in 99 and then in 2004. And the Russians complained continually And then it came up again in, 2007-08, when there was talk at that point of Ukraine and Georgia joining. And at that point, in 2008, remember, now we hear, it's glibly said, and then Russia invaded Georgia. Well, actually, yes, they did, but that was preceded by a very deliberate provocation or initiative by the Georgian leader, Saakashvili, to move into what was a sort of Russian, whatever you want to call it, protectorate or something, South Ossetia, with the aim, and I know this from having talked to a lot of the people in the who were involved both in Georgia and in Washington at the time, with the aim, as one of them said, of flipping Misha Saakashvili wanted to flip us into a war. And actually at that point, the Bush himself and Condoleezza Rice and Stephen Hadley, the National Security Advisor, went to some lengths to tamp that down, to tell Saakashvili they were not going to intervene on his behalf, not going to support him in his efforts, in Bush's word, to start World War III. So, there has been, we have to prefigure this by proceed. We have to say, of course, what Putin has done is absolutely disgraceful. But it's kind of easy to understand. There has been sustained efforts to push NATO forward to appear in a what to Russians might seem like Russian leadership might seem like a threatening posture, and to people say there's a saying that NATO exists to deal with the instability that its own existence creates.
I'm wondering if Timothy Snyder can respond to this issue of the NATO expansion. But also, I happen to be unfortunately old enough to remember the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, when President Kennedy was ready to go to war, if necessary, with the Soviet Union over the fact that the Soviet Union was putting missiles in an independent country, Cuba, but the United States felt threatened by the ability of the Soviet Union to enter its sphere of influence. I'm wondering if you see any parallels with the mentality of Putin right now.
So let me roll back to the history, and I'll end with Cuba. So there, when Germany was unified, the Americans and the Soviets did make an arrangement about West Germany and East Germany. That arrangement, however, did not foresee and had nothing to do with the subsequent collapse of the Soviet Union after we're talking about something that happened in 1990. In 1991, to everyone's surprise, the Soviet Union no longer existed. And after that point, it's very important to remember that the world isn't just about Washington and Moscow. It's also about other sovereign states and other peoples who can express their desires and have their own foreign policies. So when we speak of NATO enlargement, I mean, that's a bit of a misnomer. NATO was not there to enlarge. There wasn't much willingness on the part of Western Europe or the US to enlarge. It was the East Europeans themselves who pushed the process forward. I mean, we can decide that they didn't understand their own national interests, but that's how the process unfolded. It came from the East Europeans. And there was never an understanding between the United States and Russia after 1991 that this wasn't going to happen. It's true that the Russians objected, but it's also true that their understanding of NATO has changed drastically after NATO expansion halted and with the re-election of Mr. Putin. In the 1990s and 2000s, Russia and NATO cooperated, not least in Afghanistan, where the Russians tended to insist that the Americans and NATO had to take a harder line than they were taking. Mr. Putin himself referred to NATO well into the 21st century as a defensive alliance. He himself has changed drastically the way that he speaks about NATO. He uses it essentially as a way to try to rally the Russian population. Now, I would distinguish between what Mr. Putin says about this war and what the Russians think. It's very hard to find, at least as far as I can read the data, a Russian opinion that somehow Russia was threatened by Ukraine in 2022. I'm not seeing that. But in an important and fundamental way, this entire discussion is moot, because now we know, given the way that the Russians are prosecuting this war, that never had anything to do with the ostensible motivations that they cited in late 2021. Given the way that they're prosecuting this war, we know that it's about the destruction of the Ukrainian state, given what they say and what they're doing. So I think it's important to also give the Russians agency to give Mr. Putin agency, to understand that he might have motives which go beyond things that we do or go beyond the things he says that he thinks we'll understand. Now, on Cuba, Cuba encourages me in an odd way, because in Cuba, the Americans made a deal. We pulled our missiles out of Turkey. That was the deal. I think there are arrangements that can be made to stop this war. I think there are compromises that can be found.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Clearly, a discussion that we need to continue at a future date. Timothy Snyder, Yale, professor of history, author of many books, including The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America, and On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. And thank you to Andrew Coburn, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, his new book, The Spoils of War, Power, Profit, and the American War Machine. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Tapes on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3.
I'll knock it square. We were carried away. We studied an entire.
Hey, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3. I'm Claude Glass. This is yet another episode of Nucleotapes, a show where we look at an artist's DNA. And on today's episode, we are looking at one of my favorite modern musicians, Kate LeBond. Kate LeBond was born in Wales, has so far released 5 albums, and her breakthrough kind of came in 2013 with Mug Museum. We just heard a track from that called Duke. She has continued to build on that sort of sound on the next 2 subsequent records, 2016's Crab Day and 2019's Reward. Intelligently constructed, sort of angular psych pop. She really effortlessly combines so many of my favorite sorts of genres and sounds. I firmly believe that her last release, 2019's Reward, is one of the best albums of the 2010s. Seems like lately she's kind of on track to release an album every 3 years, which means, hey, one should be coming pretty soon, next year. Although I have read in interviews and stuff that, especially around the 2016 record, started to